It's a great pleasure for me to be here to welcome you all to this lecture and to welcome our speaker, Professor Marty Chalfie. Before I introduce Professor Chalfie, though, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today. Professor Chalfie went to Harvard, initially intending to study mathematics, but he soon switched to biochemistry, although at the time he hedged his career bets with studies in law, theatre and Russian literature, and was quite equivocal about whether he'd pursue a research career. After graduating from Harvard in 1969 with a BA, he took several part-time jobs, including teaching and selling couture for his parents' dressmaking company, before teaching and then joining a research lab at Yale in 1971. His success there, and I think it's fair to say his adventurousness, given that over a summer period he was given a project to do, his supervisor left to go overseas. He didn't do that project. He did one that he thought was more interesting and identified something very significant, and that really kicked off his career. So Professor Chalfie undertook postdoctoral research on the physically diminutive, but for those of us who work on Drosophila, a rather towering model organism, Caenorhabditis elegans, a little nematode. He went to Cambridge to do that with the 2002 Nobel laureates Sidney Brenner and John Sulston. In 1982, he joined the faculty of Columbia University, where he's been ever since and is now the William R. Keenan Junior Professor of Biological Sciences. Now, as I mentioned, Professor Chalfie uses C. elegans as his model, and he uses it to investigate nerve cell development and function, concentrating primarily on the mechanosensory neurons. In 2008, he shared the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, and we were very relieved to find the poster, the 2008 Nobel Prize poster just around the corner. With Osamu Shimomura and Roger Chen for the discovery and development of the green fluorescent protein. Now, GFP, the green fluorescent protein, has become a fundamental tool of cell biology, developmental biology, genetics, neurobiology, pretty much anything that's molecular, cellular, genetic in the biological world. And, of course, it's contributed enormously to studies in medical research as well. Professor Chalfie was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2003, the National Academy of Sciences in 2004, the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2007, and the Institute of Medicine in 2009. But I think it's significant that another accolade was the Harold S. Ulan Trophy he received as captain of the Harvard swimming team for his leadership, sportsmanship, and team cooperation. And I can tell you...
But not for my good swimming.
And I can tell you that he continues to display these types of qualities in the way that he freely passes work and materials out to the research community. We're very privileged to have Professor Chalfie to talk to us this afternoon. Professor Chalfie.
Thank you, Rob, for that very nice introduction, and you and Francis and everyone here for the invitation to come, and actually my first time in Australia, so it's very nice. Can you not hear me? Should I just scream?
That's good now.
Okay. I'll just talk loudly. I'm used to that. So what I want to talk about really is sort of the discovery of GFP and a little bit about, since I was told this is a general audience, about how...
I think it's probably not turned on. Let's just see.
We can try this. It is on.
It's not very powerful, yeah.
It's on.
Okay.
Maybe that'll be better. No one can tell. Can the people in the back hear me? Good. Then I'll try to keep up this volume. So I want to talk a little bit about... Well, use GFP as an example of how science is done. A few months ago, I was asked to talk to some New York City high school teachers of science. And that got me thinking about how I was taught about science when I was in elementary and high school. And so I made a list of all the things that I was told by the examples of the scientists that I heard about. want to go through them, basically because every single one of them is not true. Okay, so what are the things that I was taught about scientists? By the examples of reading about or hearing about Galileo or Einstein or Newton, these people. Well, one of the first things was scientists are geniuses, right? That scientific ability is innate. If you don't have it from the moment you're born, you can never learn it. Because all these spectacular scientists that we heard about all seem to have it. Now, part of this means that scientists' experiments work all the time. And they certainly work the first time. They might have to repeat them a couple times, but they certainly, they work all the time. And that they use something called a scientific method, right? You think about a problem, come up with a hypothesis, and test that. It's all very purposeful, at least when we hear the stories of these people. Now, scientists also, until Watson and Crick, all scientists worked alone. They might have an assistant named Igor, but other than that, they always worked on their own. And the other thing about them is that all scientists, or all the scientists I ever heard about in the 1950s and 1960s, except for Marie Curie, were all European or of European descent. That's what scientists were. So what I want to tell you is that GFP is a good example of how all of this is complete nonsense. So let me tell you how I got interested in this wonderful protein, the green fluorescent protein. I didn't know it existed. I was working on, as I said before, I was working on this small nematode, Cenorhabditis elegans, and I was interested in trying to understand the molecules that allow us to detect the outside world when the outside world, the stimulus, is a mechanical signal. Now, biologists for the last 128 years or so have understood the molecule, known about the molecule, rhodopsin, that allows us to detect light. That's because it was a molecule that was easily isolated. So we knew about rhodopsin and took people many years then to try to understand how that initial signal, light, gets converted into a signal in the cell that can be then used. And in the last 30 or so years, biologists have learned an enormous amount of how a signal is converted into an electrical signal in the cell if that signal is a chemical signal. So we understand how we know the molecules that allow us to smell, the molecules that allow us to taste. For internal chemical signaling, we know how neurotransmitters work and how hormones work. We know about the receptors that they have. But we have a vast number of senses that work not by radiant energy or by chemical interactions, but because of some sort of physical manipulation of the cells. So our sense of hearing, the hair cells in our inner ear, work because the sound waves are converted to a water wave that then gets detected by the hair cells. We have also cells in our inner ear in the vestibular system that allow us to detect acceleration. We have five different types of cells in our skin that allow us to detect different types of touch. Harsh touch, gentle touch, texture, and low and high frequency vibration. We have cells that detect blood pressure. We have cells in our bones that detect the force put on the bones. The doctor, when you go to the doctor hits you just below the knee and your leg kicks up. That's because the doctor has activated the stretch receptors in the muscles. As I said, bones have these sensors too. This is why if you play tennis and you only use one arm to move the racket, those bones will become a lot stronger because of the force put on them than the bones in the other arm. Or in the opposite direction, we take people, put them out in the space, and their bones fall apart after a while because there's essentially no gravity to affect them. So all of these mechanically driven senses have one thing in common. We have no clue as to how they work, which means that I'm in business for a while to come. And I've been using this small animal, Cenorhabditis elegans. Is it possible to get the lights off at the board? And it's an animal we know a lot about. We know this was the first animal, or only animal, that we know every single cell division, starting from the fertilized egg all the way to the adult. The animal has been sliced like a salami for the electron microscope. The sections have been blown up 10,000 times. And although it only took 17 years to do, every single cell has been traced in this animal. We know all of the connections made by the nervous system. There's only 302 nerve cells, but we know the 7,000 or so synapses that they make to each other. So it's the only animal we have the complete wiring diagram. It was the first first animal to have its entire genome sequenced. It was, in fact, the model that set up the Human Genome Sequencing Project. And it's very easy to get mutants. And so I have been studying mutants that are insensitive to touch. Now, the animal as an adult is, this is actually a larval animal here in this picture. But this animal is only a quarter of a millimeter long. Adults are a millimeter long. You might ask, how do you test touch in an animal that's only a millimeter long as an adult? Very sophisticated methods. We take an eyebrow hair, usually because eyebrow hairs are not cut and they taper nicely. You glue it onto a toothpick and you tickle the animal here in the tail and it moves forward, or you tickle it up in the head and it moves backwards. And then you give it a chemical to cause mutations and you look at the subsequent progeny and you ask, can you find any animals that don't move when you tickle them? Now, there's a problem with this experiment because you cannot distinguish touch-insensitive animals from dead animals. So we actually have a little harsher stimulus, and we actually know the cells in this animal that respond to the gentle touch of the tickling, but not the harsh touch when we hit it a little bit harder. By the way, none of the animals have ever complained. But as we were obtaining the mutants that were defective in touch to try to understand what the molecular mechanisms were that underlie this activity, we started cloning the genes. Once we'd cloned the genes, the first question that we wanted to answer was, what cells activate these genes? Where is the gene turned on? And at the time, this is about 1989, there were several ways that one could do this experiment. Because DNA makes RNA, makes protein, you can make an antibody against the protein and ask where was it expressed. And so we had antibody staining. We could also, because genes have two parts, the part that says what protein should be made and the part that says when, where, and how much, the regulatory part. You take that regulatory part and have it make something else that you could detect, like an enzyme. So beta-galactosidase using the E. coli LacZ gene was very popular. Again, we could see it in these six cells. These are the six cells that are the touch-sensing cells. Or we could actually look at the RNA that was made from the gene and detect that by a method called in situ hybridization. And again, you can see the cells are labeled here as well. Now, all of these methods answered the question. They would allow us to say what cells activated a particular gene. But the procedures took several days to work through, and they had another really bad consequence. In order to do these experiments, we had to kill the animals and prepare them, fix them, and then permeabilize the animals, the specimens, to be able to get the antibody in, or the substrate for the enzyme, or the probe for the in situ hybridization. So this meant we only had a very static view of what was going on. We were only able to look at this one snapshot in time. We weren't able to see anything occurring in a living organism. And of course, we had to do this all over again, because once we did the prep, then we'd just have to repeat the whole procedure all over again. And this is when 1989, actually April 25th, and probably about 5 or 6 minutes after noon on that day, that inspiration struck. Now, everyone has their own examples of inspiration. My favorite is this Nick Kim cartoon, Cambridge 1953, shortly before discovering the structure of DNA, Watson and Crick, depressed by their lack of progress, visit the local pub, I'll have a double Felix. I'll let the biologists explain that to the rest of you. In any case, unfortunately, my inspiration did not come at in a pub, but rather at in a seminar in our department, and in it, a neurobiologist named Paul Brehm, before he actually started talking about his work, talked about the work of this man, Osamu Shimomura, who shared the prize with me in 2008, and Osamu's work with this jellyfish, Aquaria victoria. Now, I have to point out that while this is a good picture of Osamu, this is a bad picture of the jellyfish. Because the jellyfish, although this picture is very nice, it's very nice color blue, the jellyfish do not produce a blue light. They produce a green light. This is actually important for the story. I should also point out something. I'm going to go back to that previous slide, not this slide, and point out that I have a color code. These people, Hong Ping Du, Shohei Mitani, were people that did work in my lab, and so their names are in red. Later you'll see some people whose names are in blue. Those are collaborators. And some people, like Osamu, their names are in black. That represents somebody who did something I wish I had done. Now, if you have a free half hour or so, I strongly recommend that you take it and use it to go to the NobelPrize.org website and listen to his Nobel Prize acceptance speech or read his biography. Osamu is really a remarkable individual who at the age of 16 was told, you have to quit school. You have to go work in a factory, and the factory is not here in the city where you were born. It's across the mountains in the adjacent valley. You have to go over there. So he goes over there. He's working over there. That turns out actually to be good because the city at the time was 1945, and the city was Nagasaki. And so he was protected by the mountains from the atomic bomb blast. He went in the next day and helped rescue and care for people. But the university that he wanted to go to had been destroyed. Eventually, it was possible for him to go to the pharmacy school, which was the first college that was built near him. And so he went there for his undergraduate years and then went to work at Nagoya University as a technician. And he was given one of the projects that we usually reserve only for those special graduate students. You know, those projects that we don't tell them that there'd been several other people that had tried them and they'd all failed. But he was given this project. And his project was very interesting. He was supposed to figure out the biochemistry that allowed a small crustacean called Cypridina to be bioluminescent. Now, there's many different organisms, at least 50 different organisms, that actually generate light. They are bioluminescent. There's fireflies, glowworms, these jellyfish, Cypridina, fungi, bacteria, and they all do it in a different way, or all the different phyla represented. The organisms do it and produce light in a different way. So his project was to use this crustacean and try to find out the biochemistry. And he succeeded. This led to him being invited to come to the United States to work with Frank Johnston at Princeton. And as a going away present, the head of the lab at Nagoya University arranged for him to get a PhD. Really a remarkable person. Well, when he got to the United States, Frank Johnston suggested that he go to Washington State to the Friday Harbor Labs and try to understand the biochemistry of how this jellyfish produced its green light. There seems to have been some misunderstanding or disagreement between them, and then Frank Johnston went off and did other things. And Shimomura spent the entire summer extracting jellyfish protein to try to see if he could isolate the protein that allowed the jellyfish to produce light. And he was singularly unsuccessful in this. He failed over and over and over again. He had a little bit of an insight of changing the pH a bit, but that didn't work very well. And finally, one evening, after having tried the experiment many, many times, and this is where the scientific method comes in, he took the preps, he was all finished with them, he threw them in the sink. Now, in the sink were jellyfish parts, some seawater, things like that. And it was late at night, he turned off the light of the lab, and he's just about to go home. He looks back at the sink, and it's glowing brightly. He's a smart guy. He realizes that what was missing from his preps and that was in seawater was calcium. And using that, he soon shows that, yes, that's what it is. Now he has a good assay. And very rapidly, he isolates a protein that he names after the jellyfish. He calls it a quorin. And when calcium is around, it produces a blue light. As I've told you, the jellyfish do not produce a blue light. So the first accident was throwing the stuff in the sink, a tried honored tradition in biochemistry, actually. Sometimes it's the floor, sometimes it's the sink. And the second accident is he came up with the wrong color. So he wasn't looking for anything else, but the fact that it was blue, he knew there must be something else there. And so he reasoned that maybe there was a protein that might convert the blue light into green light, which after all is fluorescence. And so he took a handheld UV lamp and he sort of shone it on all his samples and in fact did find another protein. He called it the green protein. He wrote about it in about a 3-line footnote in the paper in 1962. So, you know, writing a footnote and getting a Nobel Prize, pretty nice. He called it the green protein. We call it green fluorescent protein. And when green GFP, or green fluorescent protein, is present with a quorin and calcium, then you get the green light that's produced. So I'm listening to this seminar in 1989, and I know that I've been working on an organism that I want to know where the genes are expressed. I also know something about the organism that I've been saying for like the 10 years prior to this, is that the animal was transparent. Now, if I had been working on mice, I would probably have fallen asleep by this time in the seminar. But I was working on an organism that was transparent. I wanted to know where genes were expressed. And I also knew it took a lot of work. And I said, what if we just put the DNA for GFP into the animal? Wherever GFP would be made, we'd be able to see it in the animal. And I must admit that I do not remember, and I know I didn't pay any attention to the rest of the seminar. I just I was fascinated about this idea. And the next day, I was able to find the one person who was in the process of cloning the gene, Douglas Prasher. And Douglas and I decided we would collaborate as soon as he was able to get the DNA for GFP. And we had a bunch of problems, which I'm not going to go into now. About 3 years later, I had a wonderful graduate student join the lab, Gia Skirkin. And Gia had already gotten a master's degree at our engineering school and had worked with fluorescence. So she seemed like the perfect person to inflict this project on. And so I asked her to do this. We found out that Douglas had indeed clone the gene. We called him up, and 1 month after Gia had started graduate school as a rotation project in the lab, this is a page from her lab notebook, she had strongly fluorescing E. coli. She had been able to put the gene into the cells, and this is actually a picture she took that very first day, or night, because it was midnight when she did the experiment. But this page from her lab notebook also has another thing. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about real scientific procedures. She said that she used the microscope in engineering. And the reason she did this is she looked in our microscope and very rapidly realized that our microscope was a piece of junk. had too much glass. It was an old microscope, and although it should be able to look at fluorescence, it seemed too faint, and she didn't know whether it worked. I'm going to point this out in a subsequent slide. It's very important to know whether it worked or not in this, and I'll explain that in a second. But she realized that she wasn't really going to be able to tell with our microscope, so she went back to her old lab and used their microscope. This gave us a problem. The problem was we didn't have a microscope to do the experiments with. So my solution to that was I called up the various representatives of the various microscope companies, and I said, we've just invented a procedure that allows us to look at gene expression, and we're very excited about it. But it means I have to buy a new microscope, and I'm thinking of buying your microscope, but why don't you bring it by so we can make sure that it'll work? And if you can leave it for a couple of months, that would be terrific. All of the experiments we did were on borrowed microscopes. And fortunately, they worked. Let me tell you why the fact that she was able to see the fluorescence was it's what we wanted, but it was not what we expected. As I'm sure you know, proteins are made up of strings of amino acids. What we call the peptide backbone is a long linear array of atoms. And that's how GFP starts as well. So here we have part of this backbone right here with the various amino acid residues coming off. Now the problem is that by the time we started the work, people knew that while GFP didn't need anything else added, no substrates, nothing, no cofactors, it was an unusual protein. And it was an unusual protein because this normally linear backbone, especially at this position of these five atoms, formed a five-membered ring. And no one had any idea of how this was formed. But it was absolutely crucial for this protein to work appropriately. So people had hypothesized that maybe it would take one converting enzyme, or two, or four, or 20. No one knew. But the bet was it would not work on its own. But when Gia did her experiment, all she did was put the gene for the jellyfish protein into bacteria, and they made the protein. And the protein on its own was fluorescent. Now you understand why, when she looked down our microscope, we could have gone in a completely wrong direction. If she had looked down our microscope and believed that that was the best we could do, she would have said, it didn't work. There must be a converting enzyme. So it was good that she looked in that other microscope. It turns out that three other groups were trying to do this experiment at the same time. And they all looked down their microscopes, and they found that it didn't work. And the reason for that just turns out to be another lucky thing that we did. This is a sequence of the clone, and you can't read it, which is good, because the green part is the coding sequence for GFP. The red part is extra jellyfish DNA. And so this was a clone that was put in the red pit. Bits could be cut out using an enzyme, EcoR1, that would just cut out this DNA. But it would have both the coding sequence and this extraneous material, this stuff in red. The other three groups all made their constructs by cutting out with EcoR1, and so that had this extra stuff. I had asked Gia not to do this, but actually to use polymerase chain reaction, PCR, to just amplify out the green part. It turns out, although no one's really sure exactly what's the problem, that having the red bits kills the whole thing. Doesn't work. So of course these people got it not to work, and they would have concluded something else is needed. We just used the coding sequence, and it worked the first time. So this is one case where it did work the first time, and we didn't have to worry about it. But it was a pretty lucky thing to have happened. We then put this into worms, because that's where we wanted to do this, and at that point decided, well, it's time to publish. And this is the there are some problems in publishing. So we were eventually able to get it published in Science. As many of you may know, the journal Science, and it's not alone in this, thinks extremely highly of itself. So much so that if you send a paper in for review, they don't send it out for review until their editorial board gives their seal of approval. So I sent the GFP paper in, and they wrote back, or they, I guess they called me, and they said, well, we really like your paper, but there's a problem, and we're not sending it out for review. I said, what's the problem? They said, the title. I said, what's wrong with the title? It seems sort of snappy to me, green fluorescent protein, a new marker for gene expression. At which point they said, well, you see, in the journal Science, everything is new or novel. So you cannot use the word new or novel in the title. We won't send it to the reviewers with that title. You'll have to change the title. At which point I said, okay, but I have to tell you, I do not like to be told what to do. So the title that got sent to the reviewers was a little bit long. The Aquaria Victoria green fluorescent protein needs no exogenously added component to produce a fluorescent product in prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. This is actually the entire paper, right? We probably didn't have to write anything else, maybe just tack on some figures. But fortunately, the reviewers, although one of them said that we hadn't actually learned anything new, they did accept us, and it went to the copy editor, who then called me up and said, you know, your title's a little long. Could you make it shorter? And I said, yeah, I think so. How about this? Green fluorescent protein as a marker for gene expression. And everyone was happy, and that's the official title to the paper. That was not the end of the problems, however. The other problem came about because I was exceptionally proud of this picture I had taken. This is a picture of a newly hatched worm and showing only a couple of nerve cells being lit up in this living animal with GFP. And particularly this nerve cell with its growing nerve growth cone, we could actually watch the nerve growing in the animal. So I thought this was a good picture to put on the cover. I've sort of enhanced the color here, and that's part of the story too, because the art editor, the cover editor, called me up and said, we really like your picture, except there's a problem. I said, okay, what's the problem this time? And they said, there's only one color that we really don't like to use on the cover because it doesn't reproduce well, and that's green. Can we change the color of the image? And I said, no, we can't do that. The final problem we had is that we had already been giving away samples of this. Actually, the very first publication I had, there's the people that work on C. elegans, we have something called the Worm Breeders Gazette. And so this was in February, the previous October, I had actually written up something about this and said people should just write me and we would send samples. So I had been giving talks and giving out samples to people about this, and people were starting to come back and saying that they had gotten positive results. So it was not just E. coli and worms, but other organisms as well. And I wanted to be able to cite that work, and all the people except for one were extremely nice about this and said, yes, of course you have the permission. You gave it to us before publication. You can cite our unpublished work. However, one person made an incredible number of demands if I was going to do this. And this is her letter. Marty, it's perfectly fine with me if you cite our work in your science paper, provided you meet the following conditions. You make coffee every Saturday morning for the next 2 months, ready at 8:30. You prepare a special French dinner at a time of your choosing, and you empty the garbage nightly for the next month. This is my wife. But what Tula did was a really spectacular experiment. We had shown that if you take that regulatory part of a gene and you have it drive GFP, you can look at where genes are expressed. What she did is she kept that regulatory part, kept the part that encoded the protein, and then added GFP. So what she made was a protein fusion where GFP hung like a lantern onto the protein that she was interested in. And she was interested in a protein that's made in Drosophila and fruit flies in what are called the nurse cells, and then transported into the developing oocyte to come to lie in this region and in this region. And so she made the first protein fusion, and it was very important. She claims I have not paid this bet yet. I think I've paid in other ways, but we still debate about this. I will also tell you that for many of you, this may be the only thing you remember of my talk. I gave a talk at the beginning of the year in India. It was written up for the local newspaper, and this is the only thing the reporter talked about. Soon after the prize was announced, I had to go to our local pharmacy to pick up something, and one of the pharmacists said to me, "Aren't you the guy that got the Nobel Prize?" And I said, "Yes." And then about 3 months later, my wife went into the same pharmacy. A different pharmacist came up to her, from what we can understand. They must have written a note down or something and said, "Aren't you the wife of the guy that got the Nobel Prize?" And she said, "Yes." And he looked at her and he said, "I loved your letter." In any case, let me tell you why GFP, we were very excited about GFP and why other people have been excited about this molecule as well. So some of its advantages. Since all you need is the protein, if you have the gene, if you have the DNA, you can put that into any organism. It's been put into plants, it's been put into animals, it's been put into bacteria, it's been put into archaea. Any organism that you can put the DNA in, it will be expressed, and you will have the protein. Sometimes there's little tricks that have to be done. Some of the plants required a little bit of trickery, but basically it works everywhere people have tried it. And using GFP, being able to see that the protein's there, only requires shining blue light. Now, if you do UV light, organisms don't like UV, but if you do blue light, it's pretty innocuous. And so it's as close to sort of a non-invasive way of looking at biological occurrences as you can get, because the blue light just doesn't hurt the organism. Third, it's a small molecule. I showed in an earlier slide beta-galactosidase as a marker. The beta-galactosidase molecule, the single molecule, is 4 times the size of GFP. GFP is a relatively small polypeptide, 238 amino acids. And beta-galactosidase is an obligate tetramer. So the overall size difference is it's 16 times the molecular weight of GFP, which is a monomer. And as a result, beta-galactosidase doesn't really get out of the cell body. You can't see the cell unless you do some tricks. GFP can diffuse anywhere in the cell, and so you outline the entire cell. And finally, as I've pointed out several times, it can be seen in living tissue. And so one can follow in a dynamic way what's going on in a process rather than looking at these various snapshots in time. And the other thing about GFP that I quite like is its structure. Jim Remington and George Phillips independently deduced the X-ray structure of GFP, and it really does look like a lantern. It's this beautiful beta barrel, called a beta can because the top and bottom are sort of filled in. So it's this cylinder, and right up the middle of the cylinder comes this blue, I hope you can see it, alpha helix. Right in the middle is that rearrangement where the light's going to be produced. So it really is a lantern. So at various times we've thought, gee, this should be called Green Lantern after the comic book. I actually was thinking at one point at the beginning that we really should call this NV. And then there would be a slogan that would say, "Turn your cells green with envy." But that is, in any case, there have been actually lots of cells that have been turned green. So this rogues gallery shows worms, showing GFP in all the nervous system, flies, canola plants, mice, zebrafish. This is Alba, the GFP bunny. The Brazilian artist, he actually lives in the States, Eduardo Koch, commissioned a French company to make him a transgenic bunny. And he would take Alba, who was the family pet, would take Albert to his various art installations to talk about the connection between art and science and art and technology. Alba lived a healthy old age. GFP didn't seem to have bothered her in any way, but she's not with us anymore. I've heard a rumor, I don't know if it's true, that now he has a GFP puppy, but I don't know if that's the case. Anyway, I want to show you a couple of movies with GFP, and for that I need to remind people a little bit about cell biology. When a cell divides, and what I'm going to show you, there's no cellular division, it's nuclear division. During mitosis, the nuclear envelope breaks down and then reforms again at the end. In addition to that, the chromosomes have to be separated, so they'll go into the two daughter cells or into the two daughter nuclei, and they do so on a structure called the spindle that's made primarily of structures called microtubules. In the movies I'm going to show you in the next slide, GFP has been used to look at both the nucleus and the spindle. In the first movie, GFP is on a protein that makes up the spindle, so you'll see this spindle form when the nuclei divide. And in the second movie, GFP has attached to it a small polypeptide called a nuclear localization signal. If there's a nucleus, it goes inside. So if there are nuclei, you see GFP in the nucleus. But if there's no nucleus, that is during division, it goes everywhere. And I'm going to show you some films made by Rosalind Silverman Gavrilla, who I've never met her. I stole these from the American Society for Cell Biology website. I think she was a graduate student in Canada when she made these films. She was studying the early embryogenesis of Drosophila, fruit flies, and at that time there's only nuclear division, there's no cell division. So on the left here, GFP is attached to the protein that will be part of the spindle. So let me try to get the movie running. Should work. You can watch the spindle form over time. Now, this is greatly speeded up, obviously, to watch these cell divisions, but we're going to get another round right now. And you see the spindle then goes away, and then I think there's one more spindle. And I hope what you're seeing here, what you've noticed as you watch this, is that all of the cell divisions are taking place synchronously. All the nuclei, everything's happening at the same time. In fact, she calls this movie In Synchrony. Now, on the right, you see colors, but this is a falsely colored image. It's only GFP that's been used, but the colors are there to say how much GFP is present. So if there's blue, so we start at one end of the rainbow, purple, blue is very little GFP. As you get through to green, a little bit more, yellow, a little bit more, orange, a little bit more, red, the most. So the most are in these cells, not sort of in this green or in this blue. So here again are the similar nuclei in an embryo in Drosophila. Now let the other film keep going. And now you see this. Now it's all over the cells because there's cell division taking place. Now the nuclei reform, and as they reform, all the GFP goes into the nuclei. She calls this Starry Night after the Van Gogh painting, which I think is pretty apt. And you'll see this go through several rounds as well. But here, as opposed to the film on the right, even though it's the same, it's Drosophila, it's the same thing, what I hope you can see is that this is clearly not synchronous, that this is going as a wave across here. Now, a friend of mine and I have a theory of why this is. We think that there's been some light damage to the embryo. And we actually think we know why the damage has occurred, but we've never really tested this. But it leads to this wave-like appearance of the signal rather than the synchronous signal that you see on the left. But in any case, you get the idea. Being able to look at something over time gives you a completely different perspective of what is happening in biology. And that, I think, is one of the main things that GFP and the other fluorescent proteins has been able to give us. We've used GFP in many ways in my lab. Here's some examples here. We've used it to look at where genes are expressed. We've looked to see where proteins are located in the cells. So here's a protein that's present in this dotted arrangement. We've used it to isolate cells. And this is perhaps not a very good picture, but there's a process that comes out here and then branches. So once you can see something, then you can look for variants. You can look for mutants. And for us, we have looked over the years at animals that have more cells, fewer cells. Cells that grow out their processes, in this case, this double process that gets produced. We usually have some in which the processes don't all go from the cell body forward, but in fact go from the cell body backward. We also have mutations that affect where the process is, whether it branches, how much branching is taking place. All of these mutations allow us to study different aspects of how nerve cells are made and develop. And especially if we'd like to know this basic information to try to give us some insights into spinal cord injury and other problems of the nervous systems where they don't wire up appropriately. But this allows us to do that because we are looking directly at the cells. And these sort of experiments have been done by lots of people. One thing that I don't have a picture of is we've been able to use the fact that the cells light up with GFP to actually see the individual cells we're interested in. And this has allowed us to do electrophysiological recordings from the cells. And using our mutants and things that I won't go into, it led us in 2005 to finally be able to say that we had the molecule that was the sensor of touch. It's actually a complex of proteins. But it, by doing that, by using GFP to be able to do the electrophysiology and using genetics, we were able to find the first animal sensor of mechanical signaling. So I'm very proud of the people that have been involved in that, some of which are shown on this slide. Now, biologists are in fact a greedy lot. Once they have one color, they want more. They want it brighter. And the person who's probably done the most to do this was the third person to share the prize with us, Roger Chen, who did really spectacular work. Found the first mutated GFP to find the first protein that was not green and it's fluorescent. He found a blue fluorescent protein and then went on to find a yellow-green one. And then after the Lukianovs and Mikhail Matz in Russia discovered that corals made fluorescent proteins too, and they were red, that there is now a red fluorescent protein. And then Roger's lab went and said, okay, we're just going to make all the colors we can, and made something on the order of only six are shown here, but made about 13 different colors, so you could label things in different ways, which would be really useful. They got tired of naming all these things after letters of the alphabet, or colors, and so they decided to call these things after fruits. So, and I may have some of these wrong, but I think that's blueberry, melon, lime, lemon, or banana, I'm not really sure which, orange, and cherry. And so it was a little easier to get used to the names of these things. But it was really a spectacular thing. And perhaps one of the nicest uses of this has been in trying to understand the wiring of the brain by Josh Sains and Jeff Lichtman at Harvard, who took four of these colors and arranged so that they would be expressed sort of randomly in nerve cells in the brain of mice. And thus, by having four different colors at random concentrations, they could get many, many colors in this. And because they're looking at brain and they're looking at all the colors in the spectrum, they, of course, would call this brainbow. And these are some of their pictures that they have here. But you can see now that this makes it allows one to look in much greater detail at something as complex as the wiring in a nervous system, a mammalian nervous system. So it's really very exciting as a possibility. Now, Roger who Roger is a different, a very different scientist from me. I am never going to show anyone my grades that I got in college. Roger was one of these people as a high school student. There's a big prize, science prize for high school students in the United States called the Westinghouse Prize. It then is now the Intel Prize, as Westinghouse has gone down and Intel has gone up. And Roger won it as a high school student. He always has been really at sort of the cutting edge of doing different things with fluorescence, a number of really spectacular things. And one of the reasons he wanted multiple colors was because he wanted to take advantage of a property of fluorescent molecules. And that is that if you have, in this case, he has a blue fluorescent protein, that is something that if you activate it by ultraviolet light, it gives off blue light, and then a yellow fluorescent protein, actually it gets excited by blue light and gives off yellow. If you have this molecule and it's got this bit in between that separates them, when they're separated, you get mainly blue light. Now, a little blue light's going to go over here and activate this molecule, but of all the light going off in 360 degrees, you know, that sphere that's coming out of this, very little of the light's going to hit this protein, and so very little yellow is going to be made. However, in this molecule, the bits in between, these are domains that if calcium is present, then calcium binds to these domains, and there's a rearrangement of the polypeptide, bringing these two molecules very close together, basically touching. And when that happens, activation by or irradiation by ultraviolet light does not lead to blue light, but rather to an activated state of the blue fluorescent protein. And that activated state is then transferred to the yellow fluorescent protein, which then produces yellow light. This is referred to as Forster resonance energy transfer, FRET. And it's a very wonderful property of fluorescent molecules, but they have to be really touching one another. And Roger realized that this was a way, since all of this molecule could be encoded by DNA, then if you did the same trick we did with GFP, if you put this into an organism, put this into a cell, that cell would make this molecular monitor, which he called chameleon, and then as calcium levels rose, you'd get more yellow than blue. And when they dropped, you'd get more blue than yellow. And so you could actually monitor changes in intracellular calcium simply by using this inherited molecular monitor. Now, hundreds of these different molecular monitors have been made to detect pH, to detect oxidative state of cells, to detect enzyme activities. Another example that I have on here is one to test the presence of an enzyme that'll cleave polypeptides, a protease. In the intact configuration, the two parts are put together, the two fluorescent proteins are together, and FRET occurs. But if the enzyme cuts this part of the molecule, these two then drift apart, and now all you get is blue light and not yellow produced here. And so you have a way of reading out whether there's this particular enzyme activity, again, within the living cell. Now, GFP has been used a lot since we published our paper in 1994. I can't tell you how many people have used it, but I know if I go into PubMed and try to estimate it, if I put GFP and YFP and RFP in, I wind up getting something on the order. I did this a couple of years ago, so I actually don't know the number right now. But I got something like 30,000 papers that were produced. And since most people now would never use GFP, would never say GFP in their title or in their abstract or in their keywords, most of the papers are not going to be picked up by this search. So I think there's probably closer to 100,000 papers since 1994. To give you an example of the use, especially in cell biology, this is the table of contents of one issue of the Journal of Cell Biology, in the first one of 2010. There were 11 research articles, and as you can see here by the slide, only two of them did not use GFP. I'm working on those people to see if that will work. But it's used in lots of different ways, and you can see that by looking at the slide. Now, it's been used extensively to understand basic problems in biology. It's been used to understand processes that are linked with human disease, not by studying in humans, but by studying in mice and other organisms. So people have studied how HIV is transmitted from cell to cell, or how cancer cells metastasize, or what happens to cells that have abnormal proteins that have been picked up because of genetic disease and so on. People have looked at host-parasite interactions, all by having one labeled with GFP. In addition to this, it's had a lot of other uses. I want to just talk about one use that I'm particularly enamored with, and this is by a man named Bob Berladge, who was at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee when he did the experiment I'm going to describe. He's now at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And the experiment he did worked the first time, and then he had problems with it. So it's not an easy experiment, but I like the idea of what he used the GFP for. Berladge realized, or knew, that there were some bacterial genes that were activated in the presence of the explosive TNT. And so he said, okay, I'm going to make a bacterium that will have green fluorescent protein come on in the presence of TNT. And he made that bacteria, taking that regulatory part that would be activated by it, hooking it on the GFP, and sure enough, in the Petri dish, adds TNT, and the bacteria light up. He had a friend take 5 landmines, all of which had TNT in them, but he's not a stupid guy. They were disconnected. And he had the friend bury them in a 3-meter by 5-meter plot of land. He then sprayed that area with the GFP bacteria and went back later at night using a UV lamp and got this picture, where he was able to detect the landmines. As I say, it worked the first time. There have been others that have repeated the experiment, and it does work to some degree, but the problem is, and you could say, now how in the world would a bacteria be activated by TNT? But it's a nitrogen compound, and so plant products also can activate this. So the problem is the specificity of this. I bring this up not to show the problems of it, but to really show how somebody thinking about what they can apply things with can really come up with stuff that all the rest of us would not understand. And so I'm really quite taken by this example, especially since landmines are really one of the horrible consequences of war, because they kill and maim innocent people, and well after the combatants have left the area. Now, sometimes I think people wonder whether GFP has ever been put into people. It's certainly been put into human cells in culture. People have studied that. I know of only one example where GFP has been put into a person, or supposedly put into a person, and that person is shown on this next slide. If you see the movie Hulk, as opposed to the movie The Hulk, but the movie by Ang Lee, it starts off with a jellyfish and a hypodermic needle that comes in and extracts the GFP. If Shimomura had known this, he wouldn't have wasted that whole summer. And it's used in the film as the reason that the Hulk turns green. So instead of TNT turning on the gene, it's anger. And it turns out that the screenwriter for Ang Lee, James Shamus, is in the film department at Columbia University. And I had known him for many years because our daughters were in the same class in school for many years in elementary school. So I went to James and I said, James, why did you use my, you know, my work? How did you know about my work? I remember my students made me see this movie. And he said, I have no idea what you do. I said, well, GFP, how did you use GFP in the movie? He said, oh, we had a student that was sort of moonlighting from MIT, and he told us about this. And so I said, any way you get it, this is fine. I'd like to finish with things that I think the GFP story has taught me. So sort of remember that list I gave you at the beginning. This is another list, slightly different. So the first thing is that I think from my story, Shimomura's story, Chen's story, that scientific success really comes about in many different ways. There's no one way of doing these things. In fact, I think it's in many things. I think the only thing the three of us have in common is I think we have a passion for trying to understand things and keeps us in the lab a fair amount of the time. Second thing is that I think, and especially the discovery of GFP itself, many, if not most, discoveries are accidental. There's a wonderful line by Enrico Fermi that says, if you do an experiment and it confirms your hypothesis, then you've made a measurement. But if you do an experiment and it doesn't confirm your hypothesis, then you've made a discovery. I think that's very important. I think that ignorance, stubbornness, that's my attribute here, willingness to try things even though people tell you that it's not going to work on its own, I think all help in doing experiments, sort of ignoring as many people as possible, is a good tact. This sometimes goes to the point of not reading the literature, but I don't want to advocate that to anyone. And I think that the story of GFP, especially all the spectacular improvements that have actually been made by thousands of people, really point up the fact that scientific progress is cumulative. It's not what any one of us has done. It's the fact that we've all added on to each other's work. In fact, I like thinking about GFP as a good metaphor for what we do as scientists. That just as GFP accepts light of one color and converts that to light of another color, we as scientists take on the information and observations made by others, change them with our own thoughts and observations and experiments, and then give them off for others to change in turn. And this is one of the nice things about this. We're all links in a chain here. One of the things that's very clear to me is that it's the students and postdocs that really move things in lab. When we started giving away samples of GFP, the heads of the lab would call me up. But almost invariably, they would start their conversation by saying, my graduate student or my postdoc told me that you're working on something called GFP. I don't know what it is, but tell me about it and tell me why they're so excited about getting it. And I would tell them, and they'd say, yes, you're right, I'd send it out. But it was the postdocs and the graduate students, undergraduates too in my lab, that really are the innovators and the ones that keep things really moving. I think the GFP story, especially Shimomura's part in looking at this jellyfish that produced light, something that has nothing at all to do with human biology, really points out that we should be studying all of life and not just model organisms that are going to tell us a very small part of this. And already people are looking further afield at things. We certainly have had a lot of drugs. There's wonderful reagents like channel rhodopsin and halorhodopsin that have come from other non-traditional organisms. And I think it's very important for us to really open up the scope of what we're looking at in biology. And the last point I want to make is that I hope that you've gotten from this story that basic research is really essential. That in fact, this is the driver for improvements and understanding of human health and improvements in agriculture and in industry. But it starts with the basic research. In the United States, We're hearing, to my mind, all too often a call for translational research, that is, translating the basic research into treatments and cures for people. Now, as I get older, I like that idea. But what I don't like is when the National Institutes of Health had got its stimulus money, and the first thing they did is have 100 challenges. And these challenge grants, 100 different topics. 98 of the topics were translational, 2 were basic. And I'm one that believes, as many people have said in the past, that in order to have translational research, you need to have something to translate. And that's where the basic research comes in. And we don't know how that connection of the basic research, how that's going to connect to whatever comes out afterwards. But without that pipeline, I think we're really sort of doomed. We can't look at just the end stages of things. And this applies to applications for engineering or other things as well. I want to leave you with this in mind and leave you with a quote, one of my favorite quotes, from the physicist Robert R. Wilson. Robert Wilson was in charge of the Fermilab accelerator, was the head of the Fermilab in Illinois until the CERN lab came online last year. This was the largest particle accelerator in the world. And numerous discoveries were made, including that neutron radiation was actually a pretty good treatment for cancer. But in 1969, when the US Congress was trying to debate whether they should pay all this money for this facility, he was asked to testify. And one of the senators, John Pastore, hoping to help him, said, "Dr. Wilson, can you tell us, are there going to be any advantages from this laboratory, this accelerator, for the national security?" Wilson said, "No." And Pastore kept pushing, "Well, how about the national defense? Is this going to help us for the no?" And he said, "No, really. In what respect is this going to help the national defense?" At which point, Wilson said, "It has only to do with the respect with which we regard one another, the dignity of men, our love of culture. It has to do with whether we are good painters, good sculptors, great poets. I mean all the things we really venerate in our country and are patriotic about. It has nothing to do directly with defending the country except to make it worth defending." Thank you very much.